In just 2 days, I will meet in Moscow with General Secretary Gorbachev. It'll be our fourth set of face-to-face talks since 1985. The General Secretary and I have developed a broad agenda for U.S.-Soviet relations, an agenda that is linked directly to the agenda of the final act. Yes, as does the final act, we will discuss security issues, we will pursue progress in arms reduction and negotiations across the board, and continue our exchanges on regional issues. Yes, we will also discuss economic issues, although as in the Helsinki process, we have seen in recent years how much the differences in our systems inhibit expanded ties, and how difficult it is to divorce economic relations from human rights and other elements of that relationship. And yes, as our countries did at Helsinki, we will take up other bilateral areas as well, including scientific, cultural, and people-to-people exchanges, where we've been hard at work identifying new ways to cooperate. In this area in particular, I believe we'll see some good results before the week is over. And like the final act, our agenda now includes human rights as an integral component. We have developed our dialogue and put in place new mechanisms for discussion. The General Secretary has spoken often and forthrightly on the problems confronting the Soviet Union. In his campaign to address these shortcomings, he talks of glasnost and perestroika, openness and restructuring, words that to our ears have a particularly welcome sound. And since he began his campaign, things have happened that all of us applaud. The list includes the release from labor camps or exile of people like Andrei Sakharov, Irina Ratushnitskaya, Anatoly Koryagin, Yosef Begun, and many other prisoners of conscience. The publication of books like Dr. Zhivago and Children of the Arbat. The distribution of movies like Repentance that are critical of aspects of the Soviet past and present. Allowing higher levels of immigration. Greater toleration of dissent. General Secretary Gorbachev's recent statements on religious toleration. The beginning of Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan. All this is new and good. But at the same time, there is another list, defined not by us, but by the standards of the Helsinki Final Act and the sovereign choice of all participants, including the Soviet Union, to subscribe to it. We need look no further through the Final Act to see where Soviet practice does not, or does not yet, measure up to Soviet commitment. 13 years after the Final Act was signed, it's difficult to understand why cases of divided families and blocked marriages should remain on the East-West agenda, or why Soviet citizens who wish to exercise their right to emigrate should be subject to artificial quotas and arbitrary rulings. And what are we to think of the continued suppression of those who wish to practice their religious beliefs? Over 300 men and women whom the world sees as political prisoners have been released. There remains no reason why the Soviet Union cannot release all people still in jail for expression of political or religious belief, or for organizing to monitor the Helsinki Act. The Soviets talk about a common European home and define it largely in terms of geography. But what is it that cements the structure of clear purpose that all our nations pledge themselves to build by their signature of the final act? What is it but the belief in inalienable rights and dignity of every single human being? What is it but a commitment to true pluralist democracy? What is it but a dedication to the universally understood democratic concept of liberty that evolved from the genius of European civilization? This body of values, this is what marks, or should mark, the common European home. Mr. Gorbachev has spoken of, in his words, the artificiality and temporariness of the block-to-block confrontation and the archaic nature of the Iron Curtain. Well, I join him in this belief and welcome every sign that the Soviets and their allies are ready not only to embrace, but to put into practice the values that unify and indeed define contemporary Western European civilization and its grateful American offspring. Some 30 years ago, another period of relative openness, the Italian socialist Pietro Nenni, long a friend of the Soviet Union, warned that it was wrong to think that the relaxation could be permanent in, as he said, the absence of any system of judicial guarantees. And he added that only democracy and liberty could prevent reversal of the progress underway. There are a number of steps which, if taken, would help ensure the deepening and institutionalization of promising reforms. First, the Soviet leaders could agree to tear down the Berlin Wall and all barriers between Eastern and Western Europe. They could join us in making Berlin itself an all-European center of communications, meetings, and travel. They could also give legal and practical protection to free expression and worship. Let me interject here that at one time, Moscow was known as the city of the 40-40s because there were 1,600 belfries in the churches of the city. The world welcomes the return of some churches to worship after many years, but there are still relatively few functioning churches and almost no bells. Mr. Gorbachev recently said, as he put it, "Believers are Soviet people, workers, patriots, and they have the full right to express their conviction with dignity." While I applaud Mr. Gorbachev's statement, what a magnificent demonstration of goodwill it would be for the Soviet leadership for church bells to ring out again, not only in Moscow, but throughout the Soviet Union. But beyond these particular steps, there's a deeper question. How can the countries of the East not only grant but guarantee the protection of rights? The thought and practice of centuries has pointed the way. As the French constitutional philosopher Montesquieu wrote more than 200 years ago, there is no liberty if the judiciary power be not separated from the other powers of government. And like the complete independence of the judiciary, popular control over those who make the laws provides a vital practical guarantee of human rights. So does the secret ballot. So does the freedom of citizens to associate and act for political purposes or for free collective bargaining. I know that for the Eastern countries, such steps are difficult, and some may say it's unrealistic to call for them. Some said in 1975 that the standards set forth in the final act were unrealistic, that the comprehensive agenda it embodied was unrealistic. Some said earlier in this decade that calling for global elimination of an entire class of U.S. and Soviet intermediate range nuclear missiles was unrealistic, that calling for 50% reductions in U.S. and Soviet strategic offensive arms was unrealistic, that the Soviets would never withdraw from Afghanistan. Well, is it realistic to pretend that rights are truly protected when there are no effective safeguards against arbitrary rule? Is it realistic when the Soviet leadership itself is calling for glasnost and democratization to say that judicial guarantees or the independence of the judiciary or popular control over those who draft the laws or freedom to associate for political purposes are unrealistic? And finally, is it realistic to say that peace is truly secure when political systems are less than open? We believe that realism is on our side when we say that peace and freedom can only be achieved together, but that they can indeed be achieved together if we're prepared to drive toward that goal. So did the leaders who met in this room to sign the final act. They were visionaries of the most practical kind. In shaping our policy toward the Soviet Union, in preparing for my meetings with the General Secretary, I have taken their vision, a shared vision subscribed to by East, West, and the proud, neutral, and non-aligned countries of this continent, as my guide. I believe the standard that the framers of the final act set, including the concept of liberty it embodies, is a standard for all of us. We can do no less than uphold it and try to see it turn, as the Soviets say, into life itself. We in the West will remain firm in our values, strong and vigilant in defense of our interests, ready to negotiate honestly for results of mutual and universal benefit. One lesson we drew again from the events leading up to the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty was that in the world as it is today, peace truly does depend on Western strength and resolve. It is a lesson we will continue to heed. But we're also prepared to work with the Soviets and their allies whenever they're ready to work with us. By strength, we do not mean diktat. That is an imposed settlement. We mean confident negotiation. The road ahead may be long, but not as long as our countries had before them 44 years ago, when Finland's great president, J.K. Paasikivi, told a nation that had shown the world uncommon courage in a harrowing time, "A path rises up from the slope, from the floor of the valley. At times the ascent is gradual, at other times steeper. But all the time, one comes closer and closer to free open spaces above which God's ever brighter sky can be seen. The way up will be difficult, but every step will take us closer to open vistas." I believe that in Moscow, Mr. Gorbachev and I can take another step toward a brighter future and a safer world. And I believe that for the sake of all our ancient peoples, this new world must be a place both of democratic freedom and of peace. It must be a world in which the spirit of the Helsinki Final Act guides all our countries like a great beacon of hope to all mankind for ages to come. Thank you, and God bless you, and bear with me now. Oneaya menestus te koko. Swomen kan sale. Thank you.